sinners. It will be a bad day for the church and the world when the proposed amalgamation is complete, and the sons of God and the daughters of men shall be united, and another deluge of wrath is ushered in. Beloved reader, make it your aim in heart, in word, in dress, in action, to maintain the broad wall, remembering that the friendship of this world is enmity against God. So with that, I will share with you what my thesis is for this evening and what I hope to, if not persuade you, at least share with you my thinking. And that is that the state of education is worse than you think it is, and that its failure is one primarily of ends, not just execution, that nearly all schools have succumbed, often unwittingly, to these errors, that classical education is the only way to restoration, and I'll share more for those who aren't familiar with what classical education is or what that term means, and that a restoration of good education cannot depend upon the state. I will, as I mentioned at the beginning, COVID was eye-opening for a lot of people regarding education. They became aware of problems in our schools, including a general lack of learning, political activism, inappropriate content. And I was one of the parents who sort of sat up and took notice. But as I dug deeper and sought to understand what was really going on, it became glaringly obvious to me that I and a lot of others were largely mistaking the symptoms for the disease. And that it turns out that the disease is a lot more advanced in our schools today than we probably realize. I also want to caveat what I say before I proceed with a quote from C.S. Lewis, which he offers in The Abolition of Man. If you're familiar with the book, he writes in a critique of a textbook that was sent to him. And it's an English textbook for boys in the upper forms of school. And he says that, "I doubt whether we're sufficiently attentive to the importance of elementary textbooks. That's why I've chosen the starting point for these lectures, a little book on English intended for boys and girls in the upper forms of schools. I don't think the authors of the book intended any harm, and I owe them or their publisher good language for sending me a complimentary copy. But at the same time, I shall have nothing good to say of them. Here's a pretty predicament. I do not want to pillory two modest practicing schoolmasters who are doing the best they knew, but I cannot be silent about what I think the actual tendency of their work." And so I hope any criticisms that I have of the school system, of the schools, is taken in that spirit. It's not meant to be unkind, but I don't think we can be silent anymore about what the state of education is. So to begin with the first premise, that education is in a worse state than you probably think it is. This is George Will writing last year in the Washington Post, referencing the Nation at Risk report that was written 40 years before, saying that a rising tide of mediocrity had taken over our K-12 education, but that now, 40 years later, we should basically be aiming to achieve that level of mediocrity. It has come that far down the line. So what are some of the indicators of that mediocrity? Well, the first is the decline of knowledge, just generally within our schools. If you look at NAEP scores, which are sort of the standard public school testing for proficiency in eighth grade, there's not a single category from history, reading, civics, or math where eighth graders are proficient at greater than one-third of the population. The ACT scores are on the massive decline, five consecutive years, and for the first time since 91, the average is below 20. But interestingly, at the same time, grades are on a significant increase in schools today. In fact, so much so that in 2022, 89% of high school students got an A or a B in math, English, social studies, and science. We're also seeing the demise of virtue in schools today. Student behavior incident reports are increasing substantially, 70% of school staff reporting increased student misbehavior. But there's also an epidemic of academic dishonesty, and this is self-reported by students, both in high school, 7 out of 10 students, but even among college students, where we know it's not the first time students have cheated when they cheat in college, that has increased since 1940 from 1 out of 5 students to 3 out of 4, and that's of self-acknowledged having cheated. And then a Barna study recently indicated that 83% of teenagers believe moral truth is relative, and a significant proportion of them make their moral decisions based on what feels right. We're also seeing an epidemic of mental health concerns in schools today, particularly in depression and suicidal thoughts and tendencies. This is from the CDC. The statistics kind of speak for themselves. But what's interesting is that that is as significant or even more significant in some level within faith-based schools, whether it's the Catholic schools or the evangelical schools. The article there about evangelical Christian schools says that Gen Z students are breaking mental health stigmas. Survey finds they seek counseling and support at higher rates than those in secular schools. The article from Christianity Today was meant to say, look, there's no stigma about seeking mental health help in Christian schools, but it also gives you an interesting statistic that even in Christian schools, the felt need to seek mental health help is very high. And then finally, the decay of culture. I don't think most people, certainly believers who are attending service on a regular basis, would deny that there's something changing about our culture. What's interesting about this quote, and I like it a lot, it's from T.S. Eliot. It's from 1948, but I think it's as accurate today as it was then, that we can assert with some confidence that our period is one of decline and the standards of culture are lower now than they were 50 years ago, and that he sees it infiltrating every area of culture. And I'd suggest that all of these sort of indicators are in some respect connected. You can see in the Wall Street Journal poll that if you ask about the sort of values that were foundational to the American citizen over the course of the last few decades, virtually all of the things that have traditionally been the sort of foundation of what it is to be an American,
What you
loving
doing,
one's
sis?
country, being committed to one's faith, having children, building community, and being involved in your community, the only one that's really on the increase is the pursuit of money or wealth. So, what's the deal? Well, I'd like to suggest that this is a problem, as I said at the beginning, of ends and not execution. Alan Bloom in The Closing of the American Mind observed that every educational system has a moral goal that it tries to attain and informs its curriculum, and it wants to produce a certain kind of human being.
I mean, what are you
It's
doing?
tempting to say the
Down,
system
please.
is broken,
What
but
are you
it's
doing?
actually functioning exactly as it's designed, or
Self-aware.
at least I hope to illustrate that for you. And in order to understand why, we kind of have to understand the history of education in the West, which is actually the story of the decline of the West itself, and ultimately the loss of a commitment to transcendence. Ideas have consequences, and these have implications both for individuals, as a man thinketh, so is he, but also for our nation and for our culture. The philosophy of the schoolroom in one generation will be the philosophy of government in the next, as Abraham Lincoln observed. So let's sprint through the history of the philosophy of education in the West. Started with classical education, which I have summarized as forming virtuous citizens for lives of liberty. It's where you get the term liberal arts education. And it starts with certain foundational premises. The first is a metaphysics, and these are the sort of three large branches of philosophy, and these are the sort of underlying assumptions of classical education. The first is a commitment to transcendence, the idea that fundamentally reality is transcendent. It's not natural, it's not material, it's not of this world. And obviously, you have a tradition that goes back to the ancient Greeks, the pre-Socratics. You have the Christian and Judeo-Christian tradition. You have the Romans who asserted the existence of gods. I'm not suggesting that they're all the same or that they all have the same merit to them, but they all recognized at some level that reality was fundamentally beyond this world. Secondarily, they took ethics as recognizing that man naturally lacks virtue, and so the educational enterprise required man to be taught to be virtuous. You couldn't simply let him become virtuous naturally. And the epistemology, how men and women know things to be true, started with the premise of revelation from God or from the gods in the Greek or Roman notion, and then the utilization of human reason. And the purpose of this type of education, in Alan Bloom's telling, what kind of human being did they want to produce? It was free and virtuous man, right? Intellectual, moral, and civic virtue, so that the classically educated man is free from ignorance because he has knowledge of the truth. And he is free from enslavement to his passions because he's been taught virtue, which is a form of self-government. And then free from tyranny because he has a capacity for self-government, and the community in which he lives is free, is full of others who have the capacity for self-government. Lord Moulton coined a term over a century ago, I think, called obedience to the unenforceable. And one of the things that I think we're losing a little bit today in our culture is the idea that I have to obey anything that's not legally prescribed or proscribed. The idea of self-government is not just a matter of electing your representatives. It's also a matter of governing yourself so that we don't need laws to prohibit everything that's bad. Well, that was the form of education in the West, all the way up and through the founding of the United States into the early 1800s. By the mid and late 1800s and early 1900s, we got a movement in education in the United States called progressive education. And the purpose of progressive education was to guide useful citizens in service of social progress. But they come from a different set of philosophical assumptions. The metaphysics of these thinkers, people like John Dewey there in the glasses, or Friedrich Froebel, who coined the term Kindergarten, which in German just means a garden of children, they took the world as fundamentally just natural and material. They didn't believe in transcendence anymore. And they had an ethics that fundamentally viewed man as naturally good. Man is born in a natural state. Rousseau is one of the primary thinkers that undergirded their educational philosophy. And he said that a child simply needs to be protected from social influences which make him bad, but naturally he's good. And epistemologically, they believed that all learning and knowledge came from experience and observation. Right? So there was no revelation from God, and it wasn't primarily a use of your reason to understand, but it was how do you experience and know things. And some of this starts is with the Enlightenment and people like Descartes, who say, I think, therefore I am. The primary test of human knowledge is to look inside yourself. So now we're moving away from transcendence to the individual, or at least to society, and saying, you know, in Dewey's words, democracy is the question of what is ultimately good, or is the answer to the question of ultimately what is good. And so what kind of a human being did progressive education seek to produce? Well, it sought to produce democratic and economic man. And these are two sort of tied together in the notion of civic progress. But ultimately, the progressively educated individual is a productive member of society. And this is where you get an emphasis in schools on making sure students have certain sets of skills so that they can do things to make money that can be either, you know, redistributed to make the world a better place, or to be paid in taxes so that the government can perform more social functions, ultimately to solve social problems through the idea of society itself rather than the depravity of man needing fixed. They also have a very sort of firm moral neutrality in the sense of there's no sort of transcendent notion of virtue to which human beings should conform their lives. At most, it's a question of what is that particular society's or culture's set of norms. In Dewey's view, it's sort of the democratic will. We decide what it is that we value, and this is where you move from the shift from language from virtues to values. Or on the more subjective notion of individuals just have to look inside themselves and see what they believe to be good and then live their life accordingly. And then civic progress is the ultimate goal. Right, that value of knowledge is not because it is intrinsically good to know or because God made man to know and to reveal himself and his creation to man. It's so that you can do things to the world. And this is where you get an emphasis on STEM, applied mathematics, applied science. There's no value in the progressive education model for learning the natural sciences, the periodic table, unless you can use it to manipulate the world for some kind of productive end. And so that's very much the progressive notion. Well, that's been the predominant form of education in the United States now for over 100 years. It really took off in the early 1900s, 1920s, when it really got powerful. And between the sort of psychological elements of emotional intelligence of children and the productive side of things and the economic side of things, it's been sort of driving public school systems for some time, but we've all started to see some kind of crazy headlines. And it's interesting where those headlines are coming from, because they don't just come from nowhere. Critical education, which is their term, not mine, comes originally from the critical theory school of thought from Frankfurt, Germany. But it is a sort of a postmodern view of education that ultimately looks at the purpose of education largely to deconstruct the what they view as the prejudices and biases of students, rather than to teach them or instruct them in anything true. So now you get another shift in the foundational philosophies of education. The metaphysics is cultural and political. And when I say metaphysics, this is sort of, again, what is the sort of fundamental nature of reality? They view it as cultural and political. It's fully constructed, and it can be reconstructed and deconstructed. Man himself is also malleable. So the idea that man is naturally one thing or another is foreign to this philosophy. It's really more about what does man make of himself. And the epistemology is one where man ultimately constructs truth by an act of the will. You assert what history is, you don't learn what history is. And so, and you can see the quotes there from Paulo Freire and Henri Giraud talking about what their view of critical pedagogy really is. And it's very much about students becoming themselves and about teachers and students transforming knowledge rather than simply consuming it. Well, what kind of man does this form of education seek to produce? Well, revolutionary and psychological man, fundamentally. And this is the idea that when we produce students from schools, what we're trying to do is produce minds unencumbered by history, a self unfettered by traditional moral norms, and a political will that opposes all forms of hierarchy. And you can see that manifesting in certain sort of radical ways in schools today. And these are influencing schools. None of these are sort of uniform philosophies where you go down to every teacher in the classroom and say, is this your view of things? But it's coming down, and I'll talk about how it gets into the classrooms in a second, but it's coming down in through the schools of education, and it's becoming the form of educational philosophy that the teachers are adopting and using to develop their curricula and their teaching. So here's where the thesis, though, gets a little bit interesting and probably a little unsettling, particularly when it comes to criticisms of other schools. G.K. Chesterton said that every education teaches a philosophy, if not by dogma, than by suggestion, by implication, and by atmosphere. His point is, the stuff that's in the headlines, which you can call dogma, it's when students are being overtly taught certain political, ideological things, may be obvious and it may be apparent, but it turns out that there are suggestion, implication, and atmosphere going on in schools today that also teaches students a philosophy. The way in which you arrange a classroom, the way in which a teacher approaches a lesson, doesn't necessarily have to be something very explicit, and it can still form the way that they think about the world. So, you know, when we think about what's happening in classrooms today, and we see things like the 1619 Project, and people want to, you know, raise their arms and start hollering about it. Well, I get the concern, but it's somewhat misplaced because, as I mentioned, Friedrich Froebel's term kindergarten, right, is something that every school uses and nobody objects to. And yet buried in that term itself is the idea that children are naturally good and you simply must water them and watch them grow. They don't require any formation. That philosophy absolutely infiltrates every aspect of school today, even if it doesn't come out in the form of dogma. So Francis Schaeffer calls these things presuppositional worldviews. And Carl Truman uses Charles Taylor's word from his book, A Secular Age. It's called the social imaginary. And he wrote in The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self the following about the social imaginary. It's a somewhat amorphous concept precisely because it refers to the myriad beliefs, practices, normative expectations, and even implicit assumptions that members of a society share and that shape their daily lives. It's not so much a conscious philosophy of life as a set of intuitions and practices. In sum, the social imaginary is the way people think about the world, how they imagine it to be, how they act intuitively in relation to it, though that is emphatically not to make the social imaginary simply into a set of identifiable ideas. Ideas in themselves are only part of the story. It's also the product of much wider cultural phenomena that have shaped the intuitions of those who are blissfully unaware of its various intellectual origins and metaphysical assumptions. What he's saying is we're fish swimming in water and we don't really know what the water is because we're swimming in it. David Wells, who is a theologian who wrote No Place for Truth, Whatever Happened to Evangelical Theology, also says it in this way. Evangelicals are anti-modern only across a narrow front. But I write from a position that is anti-modern across the entire front. It's only where assumptions in culture directly and obviously contradict articles of faith that most evangelicals become aroused and rise up to battle secular humanism. Aside from these specific matters, they tend to view culture as neutral and harmless. More than that, they often view culture as a partner, amenable to being co-opted in the cause of celebrating Christian truth. I cannot share that naivete. Indeed, I consider it dangerous. Culture is laden with values, many of which work to rearrange the substance of faith, even when they are mediated to us through the benefits that the modern world also bestows upon us. So What are we talking about here? Well, let's consider some of the typical educational practices that you see in schools today. And I would like to suggest that they all are laden with values. Screens and technology are everywhere in schools today. Group and project education, rather than individual responsibility for the learning. A very fragmented curriculum, which is a product of the state standards, instead of having a fixed and ordered and integrated curriculum. They're very emotional and therapeutic and rely very heavily on psychology and mental health experts. The forms of discipline. I don't need to read the entire slide to you, but these things are all elements of schools today, typical modern schools today, that are in fact laden with values, even if those schools are not schools that are talking about the politically charged and ideologically charged elements of education. So, what are we talking about? Screens and technology. Well, we know, for example, that they don't actually work particularly well, right? A groundbreaking study shows kids learn better on paper, not screens. I don't think a lot of us needed a groundbreaking study to know that that was going to be the case. But why are they persisting with it then, right? It's always the new and the innovative thing. We're going to adopt it anyway, even when the groundbreaking studies tell us this. Well, I'd like to suggest that Wells has something of an answer. Technology is a case in point about culture laden with values. It's greatly enhanced many capabilities and spread its largesse across the entirety of our life, but it also brings with it an almost inevitable naturalism and an ethic that equates what is efficient with what is good. Technology per se does not assault the gospel, but a technological society will find the gospel irrelevant. So you see a school, and they're using technologically ubiquitously, doesn't set off any alarm bells for you because it's not the stuff that makes newspaper headlines. But it's laden with values. Same thing with skill-based learning. Skill-based learning is teaching students primarily for job readiness. Well, again, it doesn't work. You look at the statistics there, 96% of chief academic officers at universities think that their graduates are prepared for the workforce, but 11% of the employers think they are, right? So we know that this job preparation model of education doesn't actually achieve what it purports to achieve, but there's also an element of a philosophy to it. Roger Scruton says in The Virtue of Irrelevance, replace pure by applied math, logic by computer programming, architecture by engineering, history by sociology, and the result will be a new generation of well-informed Philistines whose charmlessness will undo every advantage their learning might otherwise have conferred. A person who knows only engineering or microbiology finds himself hampered by his knowledge, which casts little light on his experience and leads to no new communication with his fellow humans. It's all a matter of utility. Do you know something that is useful to society, right? What about equitable grading, which is not my phrase. That's a new phrase that they've used now instead of using grade inflation because it's now on purpose. Grade inflation used to be largely a product of the fact that parents wanted kids to do well, kids wanted kids to do well, teachers wanted kids to do well, and so everybody felt better if everyone was getting good grades. Well, now it's equitable grading because it's, we got to make sure that everyone does well enough to feel good about themselves and to be fair. Well, obviously, by its very definition, grade inflation is a problem. It doesn't actually measure what kids know. It just starts giving away grades, and it produces a real barrier to work ethic on the part of a child who says, I have absolutely no incentive to turn in my homework on time if I'm going to get an A no matter what I do. But here's the rub. It's loaded with a philosophy, too. Harvey Mansfield, the political philosophy professor at Harvard, said, when I started to call it out, and this was grade inflation in college, I didn't think it was that important. I thought it was just a symptom, but not now. Thanks to grade inflation, a professor is unable to pass judgment on a student. And what that turns into is a desire to be rid of judgment altogether and to pass judgment against those who pass judgment. The result is an aggressive relativism. You remember back the Barna study, 83% of teenagers believe that moral truth is relative. It's not necessarily that they're being pounded over the head with dogmatic instruction about relative moral truth. They're getting taught it by the fact that everybody in the class ends up with an A because now there's actually no meaning to the scale of performance. Mental health interventions. I always tell folks in these, my dad's a clinical psychologist. I don't think that, you know, mental health and psychology are bad things. I don't think that they're things that have no utility. But we also know that schools are just over the top on social emotional learning. Bringing in mental health experts and psychologists into school as being a primary function of the educational apparatus. Well, We now know a growing body of quantitative research showing that aspects of school mental health interventions increases distress or clinical symptoms relative to control activities. And it indicates it may be partly due to the interventions themselves. We're sending mental health experts into schools today and making sure they're asking kids daily, by the minute, how do you feel today? Are you okay? Are you stressed out? And guess what it's doing? It's stressing out kids, right? It's not a surprise. But here's the other part of it. And Philip Reif in The Triumph of the Therapeutic writes, and he's summarizing the influence of Freud on the psychological enterprise, religious man was born to be saved, psychological man is born to be pleased. The difference was established long ago when I believe the cry of the ascetic lost precedence to one feels, the caveat of the therapeutic. And if the therapeutic is to win out, then surely the psychotherapist will be his secular spiritual guide. This is interesting, I think, if you think about when you have a conversation with someone and they want to articulate an opinion. How often do they say, I think, versus how often do they say, well, I just feel that it's seeped into the language of our culture and into our schools, and it is influencing everything that's happening. Finally, student-centered learning, right? This is one of the real sort of big things in progressive education, the idea that you tailor every education to the particular individual, you make sure that all of the teaching happens according to the child's interests because that's what keeps them engaged. Well, it doesn't actually work because the child then only comes to know what they already know. I use the example of my own daughter when she was in public schools and she would read books as part of the second and third grade curriculum. 15, 16 books she read over the course of 2 years, and they were all about dogs. Every single one of them. Not because they assign books about dogs. They don't assign books. The child gets to pick. The child picks what they're interested in. Well, then the child learns only what they already know. They already know they like dogs. So during COVID, we did what we called extra learning, and I exposed her to the Greek myths, and she loved them. But until she's required to read something that she doesn't already know, she doesn't actually have an opportunity to learn anything. But it also has built into it a philosophical principle of education. This is Roger Scruton again, where he says that we make the curriculum relevant to their interests, and exams make no judgment of their literary or linguistic skills. But he says education is only possible if we persuade children there are things worth knowing they don't already know. And this may make them feel bad, but feeling bad now is the price of feeling good later. This is what learning is. And yet the philosophy of student-centered learning doesn't actually embrace that. So, it's not a theory, but it's an assumption that gets put into the minds of students. They're not dogmatically being taught. But what I hope to convey to you here is that we've spent so much energy focused on the dogma that we've missed ways in which just standard educational practices are influencing the hearts and minds of students in the way in which they learn, and therefore the way in which they see the world. Final example here is a standard email that you would see in fourth grade English language arts that illustrates the point. It seems pretty innocuous. Students have all read a book. They've responded to a writing prompt. They're learning about an historical figure. They're doing some independent reading, writing in small group time. They're working on some classroom behavior stuff and working towards a reward. But if you look more closely at the email, it contains all of the philosophical assumptions that we just talked about. After they read the book, what does the writing prompt ask them to do? Explain their feelings. It doesn't ask them what the plot of the story was or what a lesson that they learned from it or what was an historical fact that they didn't know before. It asks them to turn in on themselves and ask, well, how do I feel about this? They continue learning about Frida Kahlo. I don't know if you know who Frida Kahlo is. I didn't. I had to look her up. She's a famous Mexican painter from the early 1900s. She was a Mexican revolutionary, a communist. She's kind of a hero of the LGBTQ community. She painted very sort of avant-garde depictions of femininity. I'm not saying Frida Kahlo should be canceled. I am saying, or asking, why are fourth graders being taught about Frida Kahlo? They don't know what the Mexican Revolution is. They don't know what communism is. They certainly don't know what the history of art is as it relates to depictions of femininity. What's the message for teaching about Frida Kahlo? The answer is nonconformity is good. Make your own way. Be like Frida. That's the only message that a fourth grader takes away from that lesson. What's independent reading, writing, small group time other than time in which a teacher isn't actually teaching the class? And they're supposed to be working together as a team. This is straight out of the John Dewey Democratic Education movement. But working together as a team for what? To what knowledge or what end is this working together as a team? Dewey would say it doesn't matter, because the purpose of education is to get them work well together to whatever end society decides is ultimately necessary at the end of the day. And at the end of the day, what do they get? They get to watch a movie if they actually perform their behavioral expectations within the classroom. This is C.S. Lewis in Abolition of Man making the finer point on it. It's not a theory they put into their mind, but an assumption. They're not telling students what to believe, but the way in which the classroom is run has dramatic influence on how the students see the world, such that they will not be aware of it when they grow up to become adults. They will simply see the world in the way in which the school has implanted that assumption in them. So how does it happen? Well, the path of influence is probably pretty predictable, but it starts in university philosophy departments. So the pictures of the guys in those philosophy slides that I had before are all guys sitting in their ivory towers spinning out theories, and they're really interesting, and I was a philosophy major in college, and I loved it, and it was fine. But they end up getting purchase and influence within the academy, and they work their way into the other schools. So they get into the sociology department, into the education department, into the other places. Well, with state regulation requiring compulsory education laws and state teacher licensure, now all teachers have to go through those colleges of education, which are influenced by the philosophies that came out of the philosophy departments. And they end up becoming teachers who, like the third grade teacher out of one of the public districts here in the Central Ohio area, puts up on her curriculum slides, this is a third grade teacher, and I don't think she actually understood where it all came from. I believe that teachers are co-constructors of knowledge with their students. That's straight out of the critical education movement. It's the neo-Marxist sort of deconstructionist and reconstructionist model of knowledge. She's just regurgitating what she heard in the College of Education, but that's where it gets to. And Christopher Dawson, Understanding Europe, talks about this from the European perspective as a product of state control of education. It's the inescapable sort of doctrinaire nature of education that will happen if the state is in charge of teaching young people. So here's a quote that I want you to read, and I'll read it out loud. An outstanding fact of recent church history, and so this is now as it relates specifically to the church community, the appalling growth of ignorance in the church. Various causes no doubt can be assigned for this lamentable development. The development is due partly to the general decline of education, at least so far as literature and history are concerned. The schools of the present day are being ruined by the absurd notion that education should follow the line of least resistance, and that something can be drawn out of the mind before anything is put in. And they're also being ruined by an exaggerated emphasis on methodology at the expense of content, and on what is materially useful at the expense of the high spiritual heritage of mankind. These lamentable tendencies, moreover, are in danger of being made permanent through the sinister extension of state control. This is J. Gresham Machen in 1923. It describes exactly the state of education today, and frankly, in many respects, the state of the church. So that is my lengthy diatribe or jeremiad about the lamentable state of education in America. I will be much quicker on the backside here with the rise of classical education, which I view the answer to these problems, because it gets the foundational philosophical assumptions right. These are just a few little stats about classical education in America is rapidly on the rise, and then particularly about our school up in the Polaris area and our start just back in last year when we opened to 61 students. But what makes classical education fundamentally different from those other philosophies is, as I indicated, the underlying philosophical assumptions. And that gives rise to a different way of going about teaching students, a different way about doing school. The first is pedagogy, right? The way in which we teach. Schools today, because of those philosophies, oftentimes put lower school students in little pods and centers, and they face each other, and they talk, and they interact, and they do little group projects. Classical education is a teacher-led classroom. The teacher is at the front of the classroom because they know what the students are supposed to learn, and they're also supposed to model the virtue that students are supposed to embody. It's also a book-centered education. right? As I said, we don't utilize technology. There's no one-to-one technology in the classroom. Part of that is because the underlying assumptions of technology and the notion that efficiency is what is good. But part of that is also the fact that even Neil Postman wrote back in the 80s about the advent of television society in the United States. And he said, "We used to be the most word-based society in the history of mankind. The literacy rate in some of the founding colonies was over 90%. But now we've become an image and screen-based society where we get not just our entertainment, but also our news and information through images. And it has fundamentally changed the capacity of individuals to analytically understand the truth. Now it is snippets of narratives overlying moving images. And that is a very different way of understanding truth. And there's a reason why Christians have always been called people of the book or people of the word. It is not, and he even, Postman even suggests, who himself is not a believer, that the requirement of not making any graven images was in some respects God's helpful instruction to the Israelites in the time when he gave them the Ten Commandments. The images will become a problem for you. Finally, the pedagogy is trivium-based. Trivium is the classical education term for grammar school, logic school, and rhetoric school, which essentially tracks elementary school, middle school, and high school. But those stages are also pedagogically different in the way in which a curriculum is delivered to a student. And that's where we get into the curriculum, which is fundamentally different from the curricula that you will find in public or even the elite private schools today, college prep private schools. As I said before, they're very heavily skill-based. The idea is we want to move students through to become productive members of society. Classical education says, no, the purpose of an education is so that the child will know. They will know things, ultimately to be able to develop wisdom, which comes from character and virtue in addition to knowledge. And so the curriculum is full of things like Latin. We teach history, not social studies. Every student is required to study Latin. We place a high emphasis on the arts and in physical education because the integrated human being as a whole is an important element of education. It's not simply you're not just a math kid and you focus in on math. Math is related as much to history as science, as music, as all the other things. In fact, the classical Greeks would teach mathematics through music. Because of the meter and the rhyme of or that's poetry, but of the scales and map the mathematics to the music in order to understand the higher order math that they were teaching. It's also a fully integrated curriculum. So history drives very much of classical education. And it says, in order to understand this subject, you need to understand its historical context. So if you have students studying the Middle Ages in history, they're doing the Crusades and studying the Crusades, then they're reading in their literature class Robin Hood and King Arthur and Prince George and the Dragon. And then they're also studying in music, the music of the Middle Ages, and in their art class, they'll be studying Islamic art and architecture. Why? Because all of those bodies of knowledge don't reside in little separate silos that have no relation to one another. They're all connected. But understanding, if your goal of an education is understanding, you have to connect them for the child. You can't simply give them little drip drops of pockets of information. And then finally, it's a fixed and transparent curriculum for that very reason. If you want to have an integrated curriculum across subjects, across grades, it has to be fixed and scripted. And today, there's a very big resistance to scripting anything. And so each teacher is free to sort of teach whatever they want in order to meet the state standards. And that's very different from the classical model. Finally, you will find an elevated culture in most classical schools. And part of that is because they believe in an elevated culture. They believe there is such a thing as higher and lower culture. That means that there's a notion of order and discipline. Students are given a place for doing things and a time for doing things. It's not that kids don't run around like wild people and do what they do normally at recess, but they don't do it in the hallways, or they don't do it in the classroom, and they're taught to raise their hand when they want to speak. These sort of old-fashioned norms of teaching are a product or are a basis of the classical pedagogical approach, but they're very much out of fashion today. There's also an emphasis on joy by way of struggle. If you have noticed anything in schools today, I suspect you've noticed that one of the things that they avoid at all costs is the idea that a child should struggle or have difficulty with something. Classical schools say, no, actually, struggle is a really good and important part of an education. It's an important part because it, first of all, teaches a student perseverance, right? Which is essential to being a mature adult. But it's also the case that you don't learn anything of consequence or of significance if you don't have to do a little bit of struggle to get there. And then finally, it's excellence in all things. I don't pretend to say that our school is already excellent in everything. The idea is that you're aiming for excellence in all things. And the C.S. Lewis quote is from an essay that he wrote back in the 40s called Democratic Education. And he said, ethical, intellectual, or aesthetic democracy, which he takes as sort of the anti-hierarchical approach, that no ideas are better than others, no art is better than others, is death. A truly democratic education, one which will preserve democracy, must be in its own field ruthlessly aristocratic and shamelessly highbrow. That's not to say that we only want special and elite families in these schools. It means that every student that comes through the halls of a classical school should be getting the very best. And you have to be committed to the idea that there is such a thing as the very best, that Shakespeare is, in fact, one of the great writers of all time, not just arbitrarily selected, and we can replace him with any contemporary writer at any time we want. I also said in my thesis at the very beginning that I think this restoration requires us to be independent from the state. I hope it's obvious the reason why, but our school in particular takes no state funding, so we're a non-chartered, non-public school. Almost all of the private schools that you think of in Central Ohio, including the evangelical Christian schools, the Catholic schools, the college prep schools like Academy, CSG, they all take millions of dollars, either in the aggregate or even individually, from the state. For auxiliary funding, things like that. But it comes with all of these value-laden requirements that are embedded in the state regulations, from testing mandates, graduation requirements, teacher licensure, and curriculum standards. And because we don't want to be influenced by those things, we've chosen not to take any money from the state. How do we know that this works? Well, obviously, we don't have a track record yet, but there are classical schools who have been doing this. Classical homeschooling has actually been doing this for much longer than many of the institutional schools. But there's a good soil report that came out from the Association of Christian Classical Schools in 2020, I think, that studied their graduates, because they're one of the oldest associations that is out there. And so they have graduates in the ages of 25 to 40, 44, I think. And they said, let's test some of the things that we care about and whether or not our graduates are performing well. And so they tested against public schools, Catholic schools, evangelical Christian schools, homeschoolers, private college prep schools, and then their own Christian classical schools. And I know you probably can't read that. It's very hard for me to read even. But they tested on a number of dimensions: college and career readiness, outlook on life, their Christian practices and their Christian life, whether they were traditional and conservative, but also whether they were independent thinkers, and whether they were influencers and leaders in their community. I don't want to get into all the nitty-gritty of the data, but what is fascinating about this report is on all of those dimensions, the classical schools performed better even than their counterparts that you might think within the faith-based community, the homeschoolers, the Catholic schools, and the evangelical Christian schools, which perform better than the public schools and the college prep schools oftentimes. But the takeaway is that that underlying philosophy of education is actually more important for the long-term worldview that a Christian ultimately embraces as they go through their adult life than necessarily having them just be attending a school that says, we'll take the public school curriculum and teaching practices and do it with chapel and make sure that they're getting biblical instruction. And I found that interesting and in some ways surprising. So you might ask, is this just the wisdom of the Greeks then? If it's not an explicitly Christian education, how can it actually serve the purposes of the church? Well, I referenced T.S. Eliot because I think he offers a very insightful sort of understanding of what education ought to be, even a Christian education ought to be, in his essay, The Idea of a Christian Society. And he suggests that it would be not merely to make men and women pious Christians, that the goal of a Christian education, it's to get the students to think in Christian categories. And I would suggest certainly that it is not the case that an education can ever make a child a Christian anyway, right? That's the work of the Holy Spirit. right? And so what do we do in the meantime while we're educating children? Well, we could spend all day just exclusively in the Bible, but even Christian schools don't think that that's the primary object of their school. They're teaching history, they're teaching physics, they're teaching mathematics. And so what is it that a school ought to really be shaped by? It's shaped by thinking in Christian categories more than it is the proselytization or the evangelization of the students, so that when the time comes for them to actually encounter the question, who do you say that Jesus Christ is? Are you prepared to grapple with the Bible on its own terms? They've been equipped with the right framework and intellectual apparatus to actually understand the claims of Jesus Christ, rather than to facilely sort of go through a much lighter education and thereby not necessarily fully appreciate the gospel. And if you think I'm being a little bit over sort of zealous in my commentary in that regard, let me just give you a few of the reasons why we opted not to actually make ourselves an explicitly doctrine-teaching Christian school, even though our board is required to affirm the Apostles' Creed and we have to be governed in a manner that's consistent with the Christian faith. I think there's some risk of parent delegation of discipleship to schools if you tell them that this is a Christian school. I think that there's some risk that some parents will conflate admission to a Christian school, right, as an indicator that my child is saved. They went to the Christian school. It's all taken care of. I think there's also a risk that non-Christians will simply decline to come to schools like that if you put the Christian label on them, whereby all the while they could be learning and learning well to prepare their mind for an opportunity when someone might evangelize them down the line. It's what I think, I don't know if it was Lewis or Randy Newman in a book about C.S. Lewis called Pre-Evangelism. And he talked about how the founder of the Salvation Army had read the Greek philosophers before he ultimately came to Christ, because it was an upward turning of his mind and his heart. Ultimately, he needed to point to actual truth and goodness and beauty, which is found in God and in the person of Jesus Christ. I will conclude with this, and I've taken almost an hour, so I apologize for the length. But Francis Schaeffer saw the consequences of an ill-educated church, and he has said it rather bluntly here. The Christian must understand what confronts him antagonistically in his own moment of history. Otherwise, he simply becomes a useless museum piece and not a living warrior for Jesus Christ. The Orthodox Christian has paid a very heavy price, both in the defense and communication of the gospel, for his failure to think and act as an educated person, understanding and at war with the uniformity of our modern culture. So I go back to that verse in Nehemiah and Charles Spurgeon's morning devotion that talks about how it is critical that we not simply imbibe and accept all of the cultural norms. Then it is definitely the case, I believe, that we need to take a different path educationally. And I would encourage everybody here to at least look at the possibility of classical education for their child, because I think it's the only form of education that at this stage in the current context of our culture gets the foundational principles right that are consistent ultimately with gospel truth whenever that saving moment we hope and pray happens for your children. So with that, I will conclude. I am happy to have a conversation. I feel a little odd standing up here and taking questions. I would be happy to just sit down there and talk with you guys, but I don't know what the Zoom situation is, if there are people who want to. Okay. Yeah. But no questions. Comments, criticisms.
A lot to think about.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Why is Latin as a language considered part of a classical education?
Yeah, so a couple answers to that. One is classical education largely is sort of the education of Western civilization. And sort of Latin is sort of the origin language of sort of, you know, Roman society. And so part of it is to understand the Latin West. And when you think of Western Civ and you think of the East and the West, like that, it was because it was the Latin West. And so there's a historical element to it. There's also the component to it that Latin is the language that influences our language as much as any, even though English is somewhat Germanic, somewhat Romance. And then finally, Latin is a more than just a language, it is an intellectual strength builder, if you will. It's an extremely difficult language. It's almost like if you take any sport, everybody hits the weight room. The basketball players do, the football players do, the soccer players do. They may lift the weights a little bit differently, but everybody's got to hit the weight room. Latin's like the weight room for a good K-12 education because it enhances all of the other sort of capabilities of a student, from critical thinking skills to logic, to seeing patterns. It connects in with the math, with the language skills, and so it's always been a big component. And then today, it's not so much, but the real answer, if you go historically, is because it was the language of the Bible. And so classical education fundamentally was theological. If you look at like all of the Ivy League schools, they were all founded as seminaries. And to even apply to Harvard, you had to be able to translate Homer's Iliad in the original Latin. You just couldn't even apply if you didn't have that capacity. So that's the real sort of in the sort of the American sort of academic arena. It was because it was the language of the Latin Vulgate Bible. And I will say that essay that C.S. Lewis wrote, Democratic Education, he's writing in the 40s about the removal of Latin from the standard curriculum. And he's talking about, well, why is this happening? And one of the things he observes, I mean, in the way that C.S. Lewis can, he talks about the stupid boy, right? And the stupid boy sitting in the back of the Latin class, carving a little ship out of wood under his desk. And what do we do with the kid? We don't actually make him do Latin. We just create a shop class for him. But now all the fun of whittling the piece of wood is lost because part of the whole fun of it was just being a bad kid in the back of the classroom in defiance of what he had to do. But the other part of it is that if you get a 70 in Latin, right? Today, everyone says, oh, that's just, I mean, you can't have kids getting, you know, almost D's. I say, when you have two kids graduate, one of them with a 98 in Latin, the other with a 70, and they end up 25, 30-year-old adults, are they better off? Is our society better off having two kids, one of whom has 70% of the Latin language in their mind now? Or are we better off with both of them having nothing because we're so worried about the fact that it brings some people to tears? Difficulty is not a reason to sort of dispense with a field of study. And we've lost a lot of understanding and comprehension just in the basic English vocabulary as a result of not having students take Latin anymore. Well, I appreciate your time. I mean, if you think of something well, before you sort of exit, I'm happy to. Yeah, oh, we got. It ranges pretty substantially. And I think the general range is between $40,000 and $70,000. But it depends on experience, it depends on what their sort of, we've got different credentials. I mean, we have a history teacher who is actually a PhD. And he said I was doing too much remedial teaching at the college level because kids couldn't write complete sentences. So I thought, well, maybe I should. Go to the K-12 arena. But yeah, it's we can't compete with the public schools. We never will be able to. That's just the reality of private school salaries. But it's important to us because the people in the classrooms are the single most important thing to a child's education. They won't, generally speaking, remember any of the like philosophizing I've talked about, and they certainly won't remember the arrangement of the classroom, the suggestion, implication, and atmosphere. That, you know, that's the assumption that gets built in. But they'll remember the teacher that made them actually love Latin, even though it was ridiculously hard. Yeah, Jack.
You were talking about tuition, probably some in people's minds.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you repeat the question also
Oh, yeah. Sorry, the previous question was how much we paid our teachers. And then Jack just asked about tuition and tuition assistance. So, because we're a non-chartered, non-public school and take no money from the state, our only sources of revenue are tuition dollars and donor dollars. And obviously, in the early stages of the school, a huge portion of our operating budget is donor dollars. From a tuition standpoint, we're between roughly $10,000 and $15,000 a year for students, depending on whether they're at the lower school or in the, you know, middle and high school. But I think over 60% of our students receive some financial assistance. Our objective is to never turn away a family because they can't afford it. Now, we are hesitant to have families come who can't afford to pay anything, because we think it's important that families be able to make some even very modest sacrifice to say that they're willing to put some skin in the game, if you will, to be a part of the community. But beyond that, we have families who have received as much as 90% tuition remission because we have a need-based assistance. It's not merit-based scholarships. And although we just had a donor offer up two half scholarships that are need and merit-based that we'll be giving away in future years. And so there's what I try to tell people is, if you have any interest in our school in particular, I always encourage to apply and to apply for financial aid, because you might be surprised at you know, how much assistance you can get. And it's also the case that the earlier you get into the school, because as you can imagine, we have a building, we have a teacher in front of a classroom, and if we have a class full of seven kids, our costs of paying the teacher and running that building are the same. And if we have a class full of 14 kids, the costs are the same, but we get a little bit more revenue. And so we're much more willing, while we're not a full school, to make accommodations for families that might otherwise think, I never could really afford a private school of that kind. And then if you have you know, a lot of kids, right, your need grows by virtue of just having a large number of students and the tuition obligation that would be associated with that. And so the system that we use, it's a standard private school system of facts, will generate need based on your overall tuition obligation. So it recognizes it as a family need, not like each individual student gets their own sort of separate calculation. So a family that wants to send five kids almost certainly is going to get tuition assistance unless they're very wealthy, because over $50,000 in tuition, most people can't afford. So we'll work with families to make it as affordable as possible. Yeah. Students in the school, right now we have about 90 this year. We started last year with about 60. Our goal next year is to grow more substantially than that. We'd like to get, I think, closer to 150. It's an interesting thing, especially as someone who didn't come to the private school world with a sort of a history professionally in that arena. You know, certain classes were like really big. We have 17 kids in our sixth grade class and 17 kids in our first grade class. And then we have, you know, I think our third grade class has four or five kids. And so you get these interesting points at which big sort of entrances in, and they're usually transition points. A lot of daycares have kindergartens, so the families will keep their kid in the kindergarten that's associated with their daycare, but then they'll shift them in first grade. So it jumps from 10 kindergartners to 17 in 1 year. And then when kids move to middle school, it's a natural transition into the sixth grade. And it's also where some of the more sort of obvious political stuff is starting to creep into the public schools. So we see these jumps in different spots. But our goal is to get, ideally start getting two sections wide at the lower school. We don't want to get bigger than 560 students, because classical education really is predicated upon the teachers knowing the kids. Our upper school teachers read in the lower school classrooms. You'll have our math teacher reading to the second graders as part of the reading time, because it's really important that it's a whole learning community. And when you start to get into like 1,000 plus students, it's really hard to keep those personal relationships. So if the demand ever gets that big, I suspect our board would look at starting another campus. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's a more affordable
right.
option for a lot of families.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan. I don't have a deep enough knowledge of, which particular program, and I know there's sort of the Dorothy Sayers people and the Charlotte Mason people and the and you kind of have like different stripes of classical education. Apart from sort of just running the school as my job, my hope is that we just start getting American kids classically educated one way or the other. And I mean, my mom homeschooled both of my sisters for parts of their academic careers, and I will never stand here and try to convince a homeschooler they ought to send their kid to my school because that's better for their kids. I think that's a deeply personal decision, but I think the content should be classical. And I do think that the homeschool co-ops and even just the individual homeschooling classical programs can be very effective. I happen to think that there are advantages, and I know a lot of people have gotten into homeschooling because they felt that there was no other alternative, that they could send their kid to a school because there was no sort of consistent with their faith, philosophically sound, and academically rigorous place to send their kid. So if that's the stripe of a homeschooler, I would encourage them to consider us and even not let the affordability question deter them. But if you're homeschooling and that's your calling, great. Yeah. Oh, yeah, grammar. Yeah. Yeah, so the stages of learning, it's the trivium in classical education. And the stages of learning are not sort of rigid. So you can't draw like a very clear, like this age and it just like cuts off. But it's more about a child's natural development in the sort of intellectual arena. The grammar stage is the lowest, and it usually goes through about, I think, maybe fourth grade is when we think of sort of the age of a student. And the grammar stage is where you hear a lot of songs, a lot of memorization. Kids are learning to sort of, I mean, you look at like little kids, they love to organize their stuffed animals. They're putting things in order and sort of amassing sort of the body of stuff or information. They're not doing a whole lot with it. It's not like kindergartners are analyzing anything, right? And so the grammar stage is very much about equipping them with that information. They love to memorize. They love to sing those songs. They love to learn the stories of the American Revolution without having any clue really what the American Revolution actually entailed, because they don't have an appreciation for what war is or an appreciation for, what it is to have a king versus a democracy. But they can get little seeds of those ideas. And then the logic stage is when your kids, and if you have kids and you have the kids this age, I do, the logic stage in the middle school, they're little hypocrisy detectors, right? And they will call out anything that is not logically consistent. Well, that's because their brain is now starting to have the capacity to take all that stuff that they learned and to start to reconcile it and to place it in appropriate categories and to organize that thinking or that knowledge into sort of fields and buckets and see the relationships between them. And so at the logic stage, you're getting students to really start to get into more of the, I guess, lack of a better term, is the organization of the knowledge that they have. And then the rhetoric stage, as the term would suggest, is in the sort of the old school classical notion, is where you master the art of rhetoric. But another way of putting that is where you take all that you have learned and are continuing to learn, and now you start to do the why. And with the why comes the ability to form your own opinions. Katie O'Toole, we're a Hillsdale College curriculum school, and so we've adopted their whole curriculum. They've let us license it. And Katie O'Toole is the head of their K-12 initiative, which runs the curriculum and all of that. And she said, kids in Hillsdale K-12 schools have to earn the right to have an opinion, which is very different from the mode of public schools today, or even the sort of elite college prep schools, which is they want to ask the littlest kids, what do you think about this? And the littlest kids don't know anything yet. So how can they think anything? They just feel something. And so they just tell you what their sort of impulse reaction is. Classical education says the last stage of an education is the one where you actually formulate opinions because you're an educated person now. You actually know things to have an opinion about, and you also have learned virtue. You've learned what it is to, I think it was even Plato who said it was Aristotle, that the mark of an educated person is the ability to entertain an idea without adopting it as your own. Right? That's the rhetoric stage, to see the other person's point of view, to develop an argument against it, to write a speech that's persuasive. That happens at the later stages. All while you're still learning physics, astronomy, you know, biology and everything, but those are the developmental stages generally. Please don't feel you have to stay if you have to be somewhere. I'm happy to chat with folks as long as they'd like to. And if the Zoom is concluded, I'm perfectly happy to turn the mic off and chat in a more personal way.
Thank you.
Thank you guys. Appreciate it.